All right, I am here with Joanne Fry. It is May 30th. Hello, Joanne.
Hello.
Thank you for being a part of this project. I'm very excited to talk to you.
Good to talk to you too, Matt.
I'm going to start off by asking you, where are you from originally and how did you end up at the College of Worcester?
Okay. I was born in South Bend, Indiana, and after college I went to graduate school at Indiana University. Finished my PhD in 74, divorced my then husband, had two small daughters, and went on the job market in 76. Got the job at the College of Worcester on a short-term basis in the English department. It was a two-year short-term appointment, and I was fortunate to make it end up making my life career.
Mm-hmm. So what was your experience with women's gender and sexuality studies in your education?
Well, there wasn't any.
Okay.
That's a place to start. Mm-hmm. I mean, it wasn't really possible to have a background in women's studies when I was an undergraduate. I was an English major. There were even very few women writers taught in many of the courses that I took. I did my dissertation on Virginia Woolf, and that sort of became a path for me into women's studies in a somewhat indirect way. As you probably know, the first women's studies program formalized in the U.S. was at San Diego State in 1970, so I was pretty much done with coursework of any kind by then. So with a PhD in English, I sort of found my way to feminism partly through literature and partly through life experience, and I went from there in terms of my arrival at the College of Worcester. When I went through my divorce, I found myself very hungry to read other women writers, and so I proposed early on when I came here a course then called Major Fiction by Women, and so that became a kind of focus point and a platform for me to develop in lots of different other interdisciplinary directions.
Mm-hmm. So you were saying that the women's studies courses were just, or like the degree wasn't there when you were in school?
The courses weren't even there.
Oh, the courses weren't even there. Yeah, that's what I was going to ask, if there were even like women's studies designed courses.
There was nobody really had anything. Women's studies was newly born, I guess, in the late 60s. And even then, you know, so you had to have some courses before you could develop programs, which is sort of how the program here worked. We might have a course occasionally in a discipline that would focus on women in one way or another, or gender, pretty much not sexuality much, but lots of evolutions had to come before we got to where we are now in the discipline.
Mm-hmm. So can you tell me a little bit about how and why the Women's Studies program was created at the College of Worcester, and how did the efforts to establish that program sort of intersect with other efforts in the country?
Where to start?
That's a broad question.
It is. Maybe I'll pick it into a couple of parts. Well, let me first begin by paying tribute to two people you won't be able to interview who were really important in the early years of the program on the ground here at the college before I arrived in 1976. And those are Jim Turner, who was in the history department and one of the founding members of the program, and Deb Hilty, who had been in the English department and became secretary to the president of the college. She did a lot of her groundbreaking work behind the scenes, in a way. As a part of the administration, she was often instrumental in shaping the kinds of speakers that might come to campus. She certainly was influential in guiding me to some writers and thinkers that I might have taken a little longer to come to, particularly and most centrally Adrienne Rich, who was, I think, one of the founding intellectual presences in our thinking about the program, along with classics, Simone de Beauvoir, in my case, Virginia Woolf, and in many people's cases, Virginia Woolf also. So Deb Hilty taught a course within the English department called Poetry by Women. That then became one of the very first courses that we had in the program. Jim Turner had taught a course in the history department and had developed a course on women in contemporary society, mm-hmm. which was the first interdisciplinary course. So that was on the books when I came in 76, because I was also offering within the English department a course on fiction by women. I was tapped as someone mm-hmm. interested in these issues and appointed to the Committee on the Status of Women, which was then suggested that perhaps the next step to do would be to propose a women's studies minor. I didn't know much. I had to learn a lot. Mm-hmm. We had women in sport, poetry by women, psychology of women, fiction by women, women's history, women in contemporary society, and there was a course then, interdisciplinary sex antagonism in Western literature. So those seven courses, on the basis of that, mm-hmm. we proposed to add a new course, a capstone course for a minor, then called Seminary in Women's Studies. So with eight courses, we proposed a minor, which calls for six courses, for mm-hmm. a student to take six courses. So you could tell it was pretty thin offerings. Yeah. We took that, and I was then chair of the Committee on Status of Women, which brought the proposal. Therefore, it was my task to argue it to the faculty. So we took that to the faculty, and it was actually approved in January 1978. So that was our first big step in formalizing what was not then yet really a discipline anywhere, mm-hmm. certainly not in the courses that we were proposing as part of the minor.
It sounds like everyone who was a founding member of the program was sort of learning along the way, because there was nothing to base it on.
First time we taught seminary in women's studies, Jim Turner and I did it together, an overload. We had no teaching credit for doing mm-hmm. it. We had a handful of students. We met in Kittredge over lunch, and mostly we had to use mimeographed materials. Mm-hmm. We did have The Second Sex, which became mm-hmm. a very important text in my thinking about the program, and, you know, foundational in a lot of feminist thought, despite all its flaws, which are many. So we just sort of looked around and said, what is there? And that's what we put together. Yeah. And it was exciting. Mm-hmm. We felt like we were doing something new, even though, as your question implies, there were programs developing similarly across the country, though each program, in my view, was really marked by what the institutional character was. So Worcester had some advantages. It had its interdisciplinary history. It had its independent study. It had an openness to curricular innovation. And those really enabled us to do what could only be done at a small college like this as a collaborative effort among departments and individual faculty.
So you're saying it started off as a minor originally. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Were you a part of the process of it becoming into a major?
You know, I can't emphasize enough how much it was all collaborative. At the same time, I was there for all of the mm-hmm. first part of the program and served as the first chair of the program once it was approved as a minor. I, for some years, was not in favor of a major because I didn't think we had the depth of resources and scholarship and foundational understandings to make it a major. Mm-hmm. So when people challenged even the minor to say, well, you know, it's not really a discipline, I shared some of that because we had a lot of work to do as scholars and thinkers and teachers and students and learners all together. But by 1988, 10 years into the program, people were more and more saying, now there is the material, now we should have a major. So in 1988, we celebrated 10 years mm-hmm. of the Women's Studies program, and our keynote speaker was Adrienne Rich.
Oh, wow.
One of my hidden secret most exciting moments was when I was working late one evening and the phone rang and it was Adrienne Rich calling to say, oh yes, God, she would come. So I was very thrilling. And again, I credit Deb Hilty in many ways for her influence on mm-hmm. my thinking. And then Adrienne Rich just exploded so many important concepts and so much to my thinking, but I think that thinking of a lot of people in the field as it was developing. And then we had a lot of other important contributors, some of them students at the college, but also the current editor of Science, Jean O'Barr at that point. Bell Hooks came, mm-hmm. Zilla Eisenstein, Elizabeth Higginbotham in sociology, Marilyn Boxer, Gail Griffin. So this was a very exciting celebration, and we had a day-long symposium, local contributors, and then these national figures that we were able to get to come. So we were thrilled, of course, to have the college give us some funding for that, and put a lot of work into making it happen, and that was a very exciting thing. And then the next year, in 85, we finally actually got approval for the first halftime position actually in what was then still women's studies. So that's the first time then I had an official title. I became that first chair and taught halftime, the interdisciplinary segments, as well as in my original field in English, and then did the curricular chairing and organizing. It took a lot of work, it still does, to organize all the cross-listed courses, to engage all the different people from all the different departments and pull them away from what they see as their primary work. We were doing that at the beginning. It still goes on, as you've probably heard. So I was chair then, officially, as of 85, having been sort of a chair without appointment prior to that, and then proposed, we with the committee, again a collaborative effort, proposed the major and had it approved in January of 1989, so 11 years after the minor. And majors were increasingly developing. Universities, of course, had a great advantage in terms of the number of faculty they had, the number of access to different ways of thinking and appointments across the disciplines and so forth. But we had the advantage of the sort of think on our feet flexibility that we had at a small liberal arts college that was open to innovation.
It sounds exciting.
It was exciting. Oh, and one other thing that was that was interesting along the way, before we actually got to the major, we had a number of students who did self-proposed majors under the college's guidelines for independent majors. And then we developed guidelines for those, and those became then the foundation for the major.
Okay.
So we went forward from that. So the first two women's studies majors under this independent rubric graduated in 1986. One did an IS on female sexuality. One did an IS that was a feminist source book for campus. So already sort of seeing some of the directions the program would need to keep evolving in terms of activism and in terms of sexuality studies. So it was kind of interesting that those were the first two ISs.
Yeah.
And then we had another independent one on midwifery, another one that developed a high school curriculum. So there was a range of interesting, innovative work done even before we had the formal major. And then those, of course, fed the energy to develop the actual major then. By then, we had more courses and continued to have the collaborative investment of many faculty.
Yeah, that's cool to hear that the self-designed majors by students were actually part of the organization of what the program would become. So going off of the idea of students in the program, what was the popularity of the program like in its early years?
There was good energy, pent-up energy from students such as the ones I mentioned already, who were like craving, craving these understandings and craving a academic affirmation of the things they wanted to know that had such an impact on their own lives and thinking. There was also some backlash, I guess, but not hostile backlash exactly. Trivialization, you know, well, then why don't we have men's studies? And, you know, all the sort of usual diminishment of the kinds of things that we were doing. But I didn't feel that students were particularly resistant. Students, as you know, choose courses according to their interests, so the ones that were hostile stayed away. And probably students in the courses heard more from their peers outside the classroom over lunch in Lowry or wherever, and so they heard some resistance that way. And there were some grumblings among the faculty, but mostly it was pretty well received. We did make a decision early on to make the program premised more on conceptual understandings. And that meant that our commitment to the sort of activist components lagged a bit. I mean, I would stand by that decision as a way to sort of enable the intellectual maneuverability that was required to develop a new discipline, and then to not make simple-minded applications from the way the world was, but rather to think about simultaneously the way the world is and the way we would like it to become in terms of social justice concerns. So I would stand by the emphasis on epistemology and cognitive concerns and conceptual understandings, even as I recognize the need for the applications and so forth, which Krista's been fabulous about, mm-hmm. about emphasizing and bringing more to the fore, as others have been as well, but Krista in particular.
So I'm just curious, because a few of the courses at Worcester, when I was talking to Krista, we were talking about queer lives, for mm-hmm. instance, and mm-hmm. the wait list, she was saying, is like sometimes as long as the class itself. Mm-hmm. So classes mm-hmm. that were offered in the early years of the program, was there a problem with too many people being interested, or was it hard to fill the classes?
Not so much like the long wait lists, though once something is relatively new, then there's a sort of backlog of energy and interest that people waiting for it to happen. Mm-hmm. Though Queer Lives has been around for a while now and still has that kind of pressure. It depends a lot, of course, on the cultural context. Feminism had still a lot of negative connotations mm-hmm. at that point. And, you know, we go in and out of how we think about feminism. Some of us have seen feminism get co-opted to corporate talk, which we're not that happy about, you know, want to pull it back to its roots in social justice, including for all people, with a focus on gender. So anyway, back to the popularity question, I wouldn't say with the same kind of resounding enthusiasm that you're talking about in numbers, mm-hmm. but the students that did come were markedly enthusiastic.
Okay. So to talk more about historical context of the mm-hmm. time when the program was being created, what was the campus community like in regards to women's rights and LGBT rights when the program was created?
Well, the Women's Resource Center had been going on for a while, and that was a place where women students in particular would go for books, conversation, programming. The academic branch sort of spun off of that and went in its own direction. The attention to LGBTQ, well, obviously, I mean, you know, a lot of people were not out. You know, closeting was more common than not, so one didn't even know. And for reasons of privacy, it's not like you go around asking.
Of course.
And so you'd feel your way for what people's issues would be. And people were understandably apprehensive about coming out. Mm-hmm. Deb Hilty herself didn't come out till considerably later. I knew she was lesbian, and I knew that she was a magnet for students who needed to have a comfort zone. She somehow knew how to make herself available to students without coming out. It was brilliant. I mean, she was amazing. And students are very alert. They somehow, as you know, you have your own networks and find a way. I hope that all of us in women's studies, regardless of our own sexual identities, were, you know, we were too, I think, safe zones. And, you know, we had ISs that would explore topics of sexuality. I had an IS in English. He worked on homosocial relationships in D.H. Lawrence's novels. He was gay, and I can't remember exactly when and how he came out, but he was editor of The Voice, and he did a big sort of coming out kind of issue in which, I don't think it was his own coming out, but it's like, this is for our community. And that was fairly early on, and it wasn't associated with women's studies per se, but clearly the environment of the campus had some connection to that. So a lot of sort of underground finding our way, all of us finding mm-hmm. our way in a culture that was pretty marked by homophobia.
Yeah, very raw history.
Mm-hmm. It is. Yeah. It totally is.
So you already talked about a lot of the struggles mm-hmm. that you face when trying to get the program off the ground, like how there was really no example for how to do it, not very many classes or faculty involved. Mm-hmm. But were there any other struggles that you, as well as the other founders, faced when trying to get the program off the ground?
Ongoing dialogues with departments, and I think this persists throughout the whole history of the program, loyalties that faculty members need to have to their discipline of origin and then also feel to the interdisciplinary work in women's studies / WIGS. And that's a tension, and that's always a tension. I mean, in women's studies, I think, and WIGS, by definition, almost has to remain interdisciplinary, both because of its intellectual needs and because at a small college like this, you're just not going to be able to appoint enough faculty to approach all the different questions that need to be addressed in the curriculum. So you really have to be able to draw in people from other departments. So that struggle was early, middle, late, all the time.
Yeah.
Though, of course, one of the great things was when Krista was hired as permanent women's studies faculty, even if half-time. Mm-hmm. And that was a big accomplishment. And now the new position, that will be interesting to see how that develops. So.
Yeah, I know right now the WIGS department is on a search for a tenured professor. So I'm very, very curious to see where that goes in the coming years. I think it's going to happen when I'm not at Worcester anymore, but I hope to like keep tabs on what's happening.
Sure,
because,
sure.
Well, I've seen personally how it's can be difficult to have different professors coming in who are just temporary positions who bring in all their own interests. And then I was talking with Krista about this, like how a student can get really attached to one professor, really interested in their research because that's what they're specialized in. And then they leave before they could have them as their senior IS advisor.
That's right.
So I'm excited for this search going on.
You know, and even the leave program has problems there. I mean, you know, there are students I still regret I couldn't work with because I was going on leave, but I couldn't make my own whole research pursuits be dependent on which students I wanted to work with. But it was sad not to be able, you know, to approach a senior year when I knew I was going to be on leave and not be able to work with certain students who were, we had worked well together in earlier courses. And yeah, the temporary faculty, that's a big one.
Yeah. So how have you seen the program change? I mean, obviously there's been tons of change, but what are some of the biggest changes you think you have seen from the early years and what the program is now?
Well, not surprisingly, I don't feel very well-versed in ability to talk about the current program. I'm aware of a lot of changes that took place during my years and then my recent retirement, but the big things, I think, that developed over time and continue to develop are greater awareness of the diversity among women. We certainly hoped we weren't just talking about white women, but it was a lot of the way things came out in the 70s when we were just starting the program. And we had to work hard on that. And students helped us with that, too. We've always had trouble attracting, I think this is still the case. We don't have as many students of color take women's studies or WIGS as would be healthy for the program. So that's something to continue to, I think, pay attention to. So that's one development, but a greater awareness and an investment in anti-racist thinking and in diverse resources as part of the program. Same with sexuality questions, a greater development of the resources, which of course has happened, greater faculty presence, which has happened, but there's more to be done, and of course the curriculum there. At the beginning, so much of it felt like we're just opening up what we can discover about any of us in our lives and how gender has had an impact on how we think about things. And then it became clear we needed to remind ourselves to think about social justice for all people in their gendered lives, and to make that a more central concern. So that was a really important, I think, ongoing concern and emphasis. You know, when intersectionality became an important concept in the late 80s, early 90s, that sort of facilitated some of the ways of thinking about that. And then what to do with activism, how to think about engagement in the process of actually making change in the communities we live in, as well as learning about how to think about that change. Now, I'm of the view both are very important, and and need to be linked to each other, but don't have to be always doing both simultaneously, because then you wear yourself out. So you sort of find your way, pause and think and figure out theoretically how things might work better, and then invest in making change as you can. Some people learn a lot about theory by doing also, so it can go the other direction.
Were you involved at all when the program changed from just women's studies to what's now women's gender sexuality studies?
It's funny because people were making rumblings about change of name for a long time when I was still chair. And then, of course, we had the rotating chair. And then I came back as chair briefly because nobody was willing to do it. So I did it briefly in the early 2000s. And I didn't want to lose women. Some people wanted gender studies. I was very opposed to gender studies. And I was fearful we would lose women as a focus. And I just thought that was still too important. Mm-hmm. I would have been in favor of feminist studies, feminist gender and sexuality studies, something like that. That would have been probably my preference. But feminist was seen to be a loaded term. In any case, they did it when I was on leave. So, I mean, I think it was going to happen. And, I, you know, the concepts are the important thing. Mm-hmm. And WIG seems to be working now. And so I affirm that it's probably not what I would have chosen. And it's clearly not what I would have chosen at the time. I wanted feminist in there.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's, so that's how that happened. It was contentious, but not hostile.
Did it seem like it was always going to become more than just women's studies? Was that a thought that you and other people who sort of created the program, was that ever a thought in your head when it was first created?
Like, not at the beginning. Mm-hmm. At the beginning, it was like, we haven't been thinking about women in the academic programs that we're aware of, and we need to think about women. And it was sort of just there as a baseline thing. Mm-hmm. Very quickly, we became aware of all the things that opens up in terms of human diversity across sexualities and cultures and religions and races and all the different classes, all the different ways humans are diverse. So we became rather quickly aware that that opened onto a lot of things, but it took quite a while till it became a issue of title or how to label it all. And of course, labels, they keep eluding what we really mean. Mm-hmm. It's an ongoing question, I think. But WIGS is working, I think. Is it working for students, do you feel?
I think the name definitely encapsulates what we're learning and what the goals are from the degree. I'm curious to see if a name change will ever come again to something like feminist studies, because I think today, in my opinion, feminist is not such a... It's controversial a controversial term.
Right, right.
So I'm very curious to see if that is ever going to become part of the name.
I would still love to see it be part of a name, but I would also love that to be accompanied by the reminder that feminist isn't just about me getting my own kind of thing. If you're a woman and you want equal rights, then you're a feminist. Mm-hmm. I don't really buy that. Yeah. I think if you're a feminist, you care about social justice for all people. And so I would like that to be evident somehow in the definition of feminist that I would love to see in the program title.
Me and Dr. Craven, because she asked me what I would like to see in the program, and I was talking about it'd be interesting if there could be sort of like a general education requirement, like a feminist or social justice like requirement.
And we've had that conversation over the years, the having a required course. And of course, you know, Black studies grew up right alongside, now Africana studies, grew up right alongside women's studies, and in the best of times nourished each other, but at times seemed to be at risk for competing for limited resources, which is horrible. I hate that thought. It never should be that way. But a lot of the conversation, can we make FYS into such a course, which there were experiments with that? Can we require from a list of courses among these programs that are available? Many people who teach in such programs are not thrilled about students there because they have to be there. Mm-hmm. It's much harder to teach a course where you have a mix of students who are passionate about wanting to learn it and students who are hostile to it and resistant to the thought that they are being made to do something. Mm-hmm. So there are those questions, and they've been part of that discussion a long time. Another part of the discussion was early on, how much do we want a separate program and how much do we want to mainstream the topics? And of course, both and has to be, in my view, the only way to go. Yeah. But I think it has happened, but it's bumpy.
Yeah. I think it's also interesting to think about how WIGS has sort of gone into other programs with all the cross-listed classes we have now. So we have like a bunch of like women in the political sphere, women in music, women in psychology. So I think that's interesting to see how it's sort of become a part of all these different areas of study. So,
but it's useful to remember that in many ways the program started from just those kinds of courses.
Exactly.
Before we had the organizational structure. So it's a, they feed each other in the best of times. And, you know, one of the things you as a student probably know more about than I do, but the need to sort of do your best to have foundational concepts in each of these courses, but not to have it be redundant for those who have gone from one course to another. You know, oh, again, I'm going to learn these basic concepts, but there are people who haven't learned them yet. So those are part of an interdisciplinary structure that are, they have to be negotiated.
Yeah, that's what I like a lot about WIGS is I feel like it's relevant to like everything. It's very interdisciplinary. So a question that just popped into my head was, did you have a favorite class you taught within the WIGS discipline? And what were some of the main objectives you wanted students to come out of that class with?
I actually loved doing seminar because, and I would tell students this in the beginning, first of all, I was instrumental in making it ungraded because I don't like grades.
Yeah.
But I would say this is a course where you all do have a foundation. We can take for granted you're all serious about the work. We expect responsibility from all of you, and we're going to go with the questions that don't have answers and really wrestle with them. And I really enjoyed that. And it was often difficult because people come from such different places and they aren't always ready to do that. And some people hated having no grades and all of that as well. But so I won't say it was utopian, but I really enjoyed both working with the structure of the course and then working with the students in the course. Then a course I haven't mentioned, and I'm sad I don't think it persisted. It must have been just my course. Feminist Perspectives on Motherhood. It was not a motherhood course. I would insist that it was Feminist Perspectives on Motherhood, which involved thinking about how we gender parenting, how we think about gender through the reproductive knot, what we do to disentangle this knot if we want social justice for all people, regardless of all those constraints. I really loved developing that course. That was very important to me. And hard work, really hard work. And the reading load was, well, just ask the students who were in there. So I loved doing that course. In the English department, I loved doing the Virginia Woolf course, which was sort of my origin and my ongoing passion, because she just ends up making you ask a lot of questions. And I'm fully committed to the idea that questions are where we have to be, not answers so much. I mean, obviously you want answers, but not ready-made answers. You want to keep pushing the hard questions. Always ask the next hard question. That's my mantra.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite Virginia Woolf book?
For WIGS, Three Guineas. For literature and also gender thinking, To the Lighthouse.
I'll have to add those to my list.
Yes, do. I recommend
them. Awesome. So speaking of literature, I read a little bit of your memoir, Biting the Moon. I wanted to just ask you to talk a little about your experience with writing the memoir as well as some of the things that are most influential to your experience.
As I just said about teaching, I think it holds true in writing as well. You need questions. You start with questions, you pursue questions, you ask hard questions, you don't go for easy answers. So I had a series of backlog of questions. My first book had been a book of literary criticism about contemporary women novelists using first-person voice for women to tell their own stories. So I was thinking about the way in which claiming agency in a narrative form was important. So that was my first book. And my second book was on Tilly Olson, who was also a very major presence in my intellectual life. And I got to know her quite well and did interviews with her and so forth. And she pushed me that much harder to think about probing the role of class in all kinds of things, the way history plays out in people's lives, poverty, racism, all of those kind of things fed into it, and motherhood. Mm-hmm. Then I was doing the feminist perspectives on motherhood, and I was doing independent studies with English majors about writing narratives. So all of those things sort of converged on my saying, wait a minute, I have all these questions. They come from my life. They come from my life as a single mother, from my life as an academic, as a person committed to literary understandings. How do I think about feminism and motherhood together through my life? So that was the sort of trajectory that got me to that book. It took me a long time even to get to think I was going to write it. And then it took me a long time to write it. Mm-hmm. It was question driven, and I was trying to figure some things out.
Mm-hmm. Very nice. Yeah, I really enjoyed the little bit I read.
The section on the development of the program.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was fun to be able to reflect on the importance that had personally mm-hmm. for me in the work in the program.
Mm-hmm. So I guess the final question I have is there anything you learned through the experience of being a professor in the women's studies department or being a part of getting the program off the ground?
Be ready for change. Mm-hmm. Keep asking questions. Keep learning from whoever's around you and read with great hunger to understand.
That's a good answer. All right. Those are all the questions I have, but I wanted to just ask you if you have anything else you want to add or say.
Well, I mean, this doesn't fit at this point exactly, but you had asked early on, and then I ended up not really addressing it so much, the national context. Mm. And I did want to mention the development of the National Women's Studies Association. Mm-hmm. About the time we developed the minor in the 70s, and the GLCA Women's Studies Group, and many of us served as representatives on that. We learned from colleagues at other like institutions, which was very helpful. Many of the voices would be university voices, whereas the GLCA ones would be more liberal arts context, and so you'd learn from everybody. Mm-hmm. And I came, among other things, to really value the institutional context at Worcester with the way in which IS and interdisciplinary work and an openness to change had enabled us to develop women's studies here and yeah. WIGS.
The historical context of the time period you're talking about mm-hmm. is kind of fascinating mm-hmm. to me, who has mm-hmm. this rich resources of women's gender and sexuality studies, and at the time it was really getting off the mm-hmm. ground. So mm-hmm. it's very interesting to mm-hmm. hear your perspective. I feel like we covered so much in 45 minutes, and there's probably so much more to say, but thank you so much for being a part of this.
My pleasure. Thank you, Matt, for doing this project.